This is the Tribal Theocrat Show, and thanks for joining me. My guest today is Matt Parrott. Matt is a friend of mine. We've done some projects together and some white advocacy stuff, and he's here today to talk about the interesting topic of the connection between Masonry and Jews. So that should be a good one for sure. So before we start off, Matt, there's been a piece of news recently in current events about Merlin Miller's popularity as a third-party candidate, and it's increasing quite a bit, yet he finds it unfortunate that A3P has some white nationalist elements. What's going on with that?
Oh, geez. With that, I did post recently at Countercurrents a couple days ago, expressing my concern that the post itself was a commentary on the recent presidential debate, one in which I dismissed both candidates. But at the bottom, I did mention that for the first time in my adult life, I'm not going to be voting at all. And one of the main reasons, aside from just spiraling ever deeper into the far right, is that not a single one of the candidates is willing to stand up and defend our identity, our right to exist. And I mentioned in that article that even Merlin Miller now, in a recent interview, explained that it was unfortunate that there were white nationalist elements in the A3P party, and that he was trying to move away from that. And, you know, I think that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
That, you know, this party, the A3P, was founded by and for white interests.
Sure.
And even that's slipping away from us. I think that's frustrating. I think we should have a conversation about it.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was really awkward that just as you said, that party was founded for the very purpose of being a white advocacy group, and yet he's surprised that those unpopular and non-politically correct elements are part of the party.
Right. And I guess for me, there are two separate issues there. There's, first of all, there's the overarching issue of whether you think we need to incrementally mainstream ourselves into popularity, where we reach people where they're at and then gradually pull them into our direction, or a polarization strategy, a finger quote vanguard strategy, where we make a point to delineate the difference between ourselves and the mainstream, and then wait for current events and problems to arise and the credibility of the mainstream to grow to the point where people are willing to make a radical departure. But that's, I'm on the side of polarization at this point. It took me a while to get there, and I very strongly disagree with Merlin Miller's stated position, which is a mainstreamer position of, you know, starting with a sort of cornpone Americana constitutionalist civic nationalism, and then trying to bring them on board with that and deal with the issues with baby steps. But yeah, I think we should agree to disagree in the movement about that. And that's where I have the problem, is that when you start to the media cutting down those to the right of you, you know, when a leftist gets on a radio show, he doesn't immediately start attacking those to the left of him. You don't have Barack Obama constantly disavowing and distancing himself and saying, you know, the NAACP is unfortunate. You know, the Black Panthers are, you know, I'm ashamed of them, and I don't have anything. You know, it's just not. We can't function if everybody is turning on each other like that. And that was my true objection. I think there should be a debate about mainstreaming versus polarization, but that's a separate topic.
Right. I was doing some searching for him, and a couple stories came up that suggested that he came out and said that Israel did 9/11. Is that are my sources credible there?
I believe that's accurate. I mean, Merlin Miller has done so much good work, and you know, I hate that I've come out with this position. I'm sure he's displeased with it. He has done so much good work on raising awareness about the USS Liberty, and he's met with the families. If our listeners aren't familiar with that, Israel actually bombed an American ship, killing people, and our government did not do those soldiers right. Our media hid the incident. It was a huge humiliation, and one of the worst cases of Zionist overreach, a Jewish overreach. I like to use the word Jewish there. They also have the Levon affair. He's spoken about that, and that's sort of, I don't know exactly what his position on 9/11 would be, but that wouldn't surprise me, because he's very concerned about Israeli false flag attacks and such like that.
Sure.
I don't think that the Jews did 9/11 personally. I think that perhaps in the intelligence community they might have let it happen on purpose. That's something I'm open to, but I haven't really seen any positive evidence of that. But I guess, you know, my personal position is pretty close to the 9/11 Commission report, that our government is just that incompetent. I think people have trouble understanding how incompetent, through affirmative action, through corruption, through just decadence and a decline in our racial and spiritual health, that our government has become so inept that that could happen. And I believe that's the case. I believe bin Laden did 9/11 personally.
Well, speaking of these kooky conspiracy theories, we're talking about one today, aren't we? Why? We're talking about Masonry and the Jewish connection, and the Masonic Lodge is a secret society, and most people think that's just a conspiracy theory, so why focus on the conspiracy theories and these abstract things instead of actually getting really practical with real politics?
Well, because ultimately that is real politics. The problem it isn't with conspiracy theories themselves. The problem is that the conspiracy theories are incorrect. If you don't understand how a machine works, you can't work on it. You know, it's the same with a computer. You can't just be like, oh, I don't have time for all these thick books about programming. I'm just going to go make a website. It doesn't work like that. You're going to run into all kinds of problems. You're not going to know what's going on, and you're going to fail. And we've seen that time and time again. And with people going into our politics with the wrong model, with the wrong idea of how it works, and they, you know, they think they can win by voting. They think they can win by raising public awareness. They think, you know, they don't understand how the rules are set up. And to understand the game, to win the game, you have to truly understand the rules. And to understand the rules, you do have to wade into this deeper, darker background stuff about how politics and oligarchies actually form and work, and a lot of it's behind the scenes for good reason. And, you know, these things like David Icke's reptilian conspiracy theory or the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, those are flawed attempts at explaining a series of data points that are pretty much universal, whether it's Alex Jones or David Icke or Jesse Ventura or, you know, any number of conspiracy theorists for centuries have been trying to explain what's going on.
Gotcha. I think it was film producer Michael Moore who, when asked if he believed in conspiracy theories, I thought he had a good response. I don't agree with his politics, but he said, only those that are true. Only the ones that are true. That's a good answer.
Right.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, I think that's sort of interesting because you had sort of an attempt to reverse engineer the obvious Jewish and Masonic role in taking down Western civilization, in attacking tradition, in turning the West into what it's become today. And I think it was a forgery, but it was an attempt to put forward a theory alongside David Icke or Professor McDonald or anybody else who's grappled with the nature of Jewish Masonic or whatever power in the West.
Yeah, I'm not really conversant with the protocols. I hear them come up a lot in some of the circles I listen to and participate in, but I don't know much about that to have an authoritative opinion myself.
Oh, have you read Henry Ford's The International Jew?
I had a Catholic priest give me that book, and I read through the introduction, but I didn't read much more than that. It wasn't that I wasn't interested. I think I had so much to read at the time that I didn't finish it, but I'm familiar with the general thesis.
Okay, well, that's also based strongly on the protocols.
Okay.
It's also another example of a grand theory of everything to explain the Jews.
Well, getting into the definitions and concepts here, what is Masonry? What's the Masonic Lodge, and why is it important to the average person?
Today, it's not. But an understanding of its rise and fall over the last several centuries in the West is critical for anybody who's trying to think deeply and arrive at useful conclusions about how to save the West. Because the Freemasonry played such a central role as a tool of capitalist and Jewish subversion. It was the central tool of it. And to understand how they subverted it, how Freemasonry rose in the first place and where it arose from, is filled with object lessons for us.
That sounds interesting. This is one subject that I really know very little about, so I'm glad you're here to discuss it. The other topics we've discussed on Tribal Theocrat Live, I had some interest in and knew something about, but this one I really don't know about the origins and the details of the Masonic Lodge. Is there a quick definition of what is Masonry for our listeners?
Well, Freemasonry is a massively distributed collection of secret societies. They have the temples and lodges in local towns. If you're driving through any small town in the Midwest, you'll usually see a sign at the entrance to the town with a Masonic logo on it for that lodge. And that's if you walk through the old downtown of any small town, you'll see a lot of times in the Masonry, you'll see signs and symbols and explicit attributions to Freemasonry. And at the local level, it was sort of a secret gentleman's club, interdenominational, whether you're a Presbyterian or Baptist or what have you, you could go there. Now, it's explicitly deist. It's they use allegorically the great architect of the universe, but its origins are actually, in my opinion, and everything with Freemasonry is shrouded in mystery on purpose. So there's a lot of speculation, and you have to engage in some kind of speculation, but that doesn't mean you have to leave your skepticism behind. You just have to keep your imagination in check. But it arose as a guild in medieval Europe and became increasingly more powerful and became dissociated from the actual practice of Freemasonry and became sort of a center for European peasants, a power center, a secretive power center, in opposition to the Catholic Church and the nobility. And that's what you have to understand about its origin and purpose. Is there were many lodges in Europe and guilds well through the Middle Ages, but because you had the Catholic Church and you had the aristocracy in full power, they didn't have any real power themselves. And after the Age of Discovery and colonialism and the later on the Industrial Revolution, you had this fire hose of money coming into Europe. And that money landed in the hands of peasants. Peasants who were outside of the church and aristocratic power structures. So what you had was these guilds bloated up with power, with money. And eventually they became a threat to the stability of the societies they were in. In France, that played out as the French Revolution. In the United States, it was American Revolutionary War, where these wealthy peasants and landholders threw off the tyrants, is what they would call them, in the name of all these familiar things that we call the Enlightenment, which is inextricable from Freemasonry. And it's the ideology, if you look at what Enlightenment and modern and liberal values are, they're merchant values. They're a merchant who doesn't see people as individuals and discriminates between customers is going to lose in the long run relative to someone who does not. They think in terms of contracts, and you saw those ideas like the social contract bubble up at that time as if that were a new idea. Well, it's an attempt by a merchant, by a businessman, to redefine and understand politics. And that at its root, there's so much more to it, but at its root, that's what Freemasonry is. It is capitalism. It's the wealthy peasant attempt to take power in the West from the church and the aristocracy.
So how exactly does that happen? Because that tribal theocrat and other Kenist and White advocacy sites, we are about practical politics, and the question is, how does Freemasonry influence politics and economics and so forth? Is there a structure? Are there oaths involved? And how does this play out?
Well, how it typically actually influences mainstream politics is not directly. And Freemasonry's record is not entirely opposed to our interest. In fact, the first and second Klan were inextricable from Freemasonry. They were the structure of the Ku Klux Klan was directly ripped off from Freemasonry with different words for the titles and things like that, sort of a remix of the basic Masonic structure. And that's where it was sort of the last gasp attempt. The second Klan was sort of the founding oligarchy's final attempt to wrestle America from the Jews.
Makes sense. Before we get into the other side of the title of today's live show, namely the Jewish connection, let's talk about some theological criticism, if you don't mind.
Oh, absolutely.
Some have criticized Masonry as being Unitarianistic in its theology. There's, of course, the great architect of the universe symbol that we all see on license plates and so forth. Which God is this? Which great architect of the universe are they talking about?
When they say that, the deism is essentially a thinly veiled atheism and religious indifference. They could not be explicitly atheist at the time due to a taboo, but they did need to bring together all these different religious confessions, except for Catholicism, for an obvious and necessary reason, bring together all these different religious confessions into one lodge to conspire.
There's a quote I want to read here by the Reverend J.F. Newton, who writes regarding the Masonic Bible, quote, "We join hands with the man of Islam as he takes oath on the Quran, and with the Hindu as he makes covenant with God upon the book he knows best. And then he continues, "Masonry invites to its altar men of all faiths, knowing that they use different names for the nameless for the nameless one of 100 names, they are yet praying to one God and Father of all, knowing also that while they read different volumes, they are in fact reading the same vast book of faith of man as revealed in the struggle and sorrow of the race in its quest for God. We honor every book of faith, what Homer was to the Greeks, the Quran to the Arabs, the grand old Bible is to us. So the typical Brotherhood of Mankind stuff. And the question I have about that quote in their general theology is, you see a lot of Christians who are or were members of the Masonic Lodge, including my own grandfather, and there are sections of Christian cemeteries that are Masonically labeled. So how do you explain this Christian involvement with a faith that is clearly not Christian?
Well, you may have a quibble with me here, because Protestantism would not have succeeded, would not have gotten anywhere, were it not for the support of Freemasonry. And the two, their history, now, I'll call them, to some extent, historically, useful idiots, in that I don't think the majority of Protestant churches actually had this universalist theology or supported the Masonic goals, but they were used as the foot soldiers in the subversion of Europe's traditional ruling elite, which were the Catholics. And I'm not necessarily saying that there was no valid grief with the Catholics. I'm not Catholic. But it was necessarily vague about religion because it had to unite all these groups that were not of a specific religion. It was sort of, at the time, it was a motley collection of everybody who was not allied with the Catholic Church. And I would argue that perhaps they got swept away. And that's part of the problem is they were so overly broad about religious confession that they included the Jews.
Yeah, I guess my question is more about those generations well after the establishment of the Lodge who read their Bible and they see that Jesus claims exclusivity, you know, he who comes to the Father must come through me, and yet they don't look into the these theological claims of this lodge they join. I don't understand how so many Christians after, you know, well after the establishment of the of Freemasonry could do that.
Well, a lot of it just has to do with money and power. There was a lot through American history of anti-Masonic, and not just from the Catholic Church or people favorable towards the monarchy or whatever. There was a lot of genuine opposition to Freemasonry, but it was sort of like white nationalism now. It had no power base. It had no relevance. Those who played along with Freemasonry had access, were plugged in to this important business, social, political networking machine. And to try to succeed outside of that machine, you were marginal. And, you know, I think, you know, because historically, most Americans weren't Freemasons. But the ones who were by definition, the most wealthy. And they had a greater impact. I think the ones who were not Freemasons just got swept aside. I think, you know, a lot of people probably joined Freemasonry and weren't comfortable with those things, but made whatever compromises with their own conscience that they needed to do to keep doing it.
We're talking about the connection of Jews and Masonry. What is the connection here? Were the founders of Freemasonry Jews exclusively so? How about that?
This is like everything with Freemasonry. It's contended. My model that I've arrived at through my research, and it's definitely evolving. I'm certainly no academic expert by any stretch, but I have put a great deal of thought into these things. Is that Jews were the other group in medieval Europe, the large significant group in medieval Europe who were explicitly locked out of the power structure. And you had this synergistic, initially, it was a synergistic relationship between Jews and Freemasonry. Now, obviously, you know, Martin Luther, a more staunch anti-Semite, could nary be found. But you did have the Jews use this and their talk about universal rights and the civic nationalist themes to get the right to vote, to get the right to directly engage the political process. And they used Masonic ideals, Enlightenment concept. These are not Jewish concepts. These are mercantile concepts. The Jews definitely influenced Freemasonry in a lot of ways, some of them accidental and some of them very purposeful. But the point was that the wealthy peasants and the Jews, who had been outside of the power structure but powerful in their own right, they teamed up together for a few centuries to completely transform Europe politically, which is what you saw over the last few centuries.
When we say Jew, are we talking about ethnic Jews or those who have Judaistic background or Talmudic Jews?
Oh, boy.
Mickey Henry was on last month, and we have a whole hour and some 15 minutes of him talking about the Talmud and Judaism and Jews, and he gives a good section on what we mean by Jew. I just thought I'd throw that out there since we...
Okay, well, I didn't listen to that show. Maybe I need to.
Well, but, you know, we're using the term, and people are going to know what we mean by that, so go ahead.
Okay, well, when I say Jews, I mean politically active Jews, ranging from Orthodox Jews to essentially secular Jews. And I think even the ones who don't have the religious belief anymore, the spite for Western civilization and white Christendom runs stronger than their belief in God. And you see that. They'll blow off their faith, yeah. Which, as with any faith, often involves like some discipline and some compromises and some faith. And they just keep the hate. So it's and that's what you have with a lot of these Hollywood moguls and stuff who you know, rarely attend a synagogue. If they do, it's just for some political aim. But they're just as dedicated to attacking the West as the most ferocious rabbi. So when I say Jews, essentially anybody who identifies as a Jew,
sure,
who thinks of themselves as part of the Jewish narrative and has adopted the Jewish historical narrative as their own, in a lot of ways, a Jew. I guess you could even throw in like Whoopi Goldberg and a lot of these foolish Hollywood buffoons who've converted Madonna.
Sure,
I think she's an honorary Jew.
Honorary. That's funny. That's actually a good point. I think it's really important to know that, as you said, Jews really do they really do hate Christ and Christians more than, at least enough, but more than they our adherence to Judaism. It's more of an anti-Christianity than it is pro-Judaism. It's a good point.
Yeah, it evolved that way. I'm not especially, I know a lot of white nationalists like they see the origins in the ancient Hebrews and stuff like that. But for me, I see they're really going off the rails with the Pharisees in the New Testament. And that is their tradition. Politics in the world would be more understandable to Christians if they would just start calling them Pharisees.
Yeah.
Because that's what they are, politically, philosophically, religiously. It's the same line. Those Pharisees went on to be modern Jews. And so many Zionist Christians and mainstream Christians, they think, oh, well, these are the people who the Hebrews is David and King Solomon and Adam and, you know, sure, and what have you.
Let's now talk about how this connects to America. You and I have broached this issue before over a cigar and drink about the Masonic Jewish connection with the founding and the current running of the United States. So what about this issue of the U.S. Constitution? It's been called a Masonic betrayal of the Declaration of Independence. Can you speak to this at all?
Well, I think the Declaration of Independence was Masonic. I think the Constitution was Masonic. I think pretty near everyone involved was Masonic to one extent or another. It was a Masonic revolution, and America was founded as a Masonic republic.
Wow, that's pretty unpopular, Matt. I didn't learn that in American history, high school or college. Yeah, I've heard different angles on that from traditional Catholics and some other friends, but is there anything, are there any details to that line of thinking you want to provide?
Well, I mean, George Washington, when he swore into his first term, swore in on a Masonic Bible. I don't have the list right in front of me, but the who's who of declared and confirmed Freemasons in the founding of America is startling and complete. And if you look at the structure of who were the people, who were the founding fathers, many of whom were brilliant, courageous people. Okay, I mean, this is my founding stock I'm talking about. I'm old American stock, so I'm not meaning to vilify these people. But, you know, these were a bunch of wealthy landholders, wealthy landholding gentlemen, who were sick and tired of the monarchy. Mm-hmm. And they threw it off to protect their economic interests. You know, the original Tea Party, it was about taxes. It was about rich people not wanting to pay taxes, just like our modern Tea Party is.
Interesting.
In fact, I've called the Tea Party in one article, I guess it's been a couple of years ago, I called the American Revolutionary Cargo Cult, because they put on the tricorn hats, and they sort of dance around as if, you know, they were fighting the same fight. In many ways, they are, but there's no longer any, Freemasonry is no longer a vehicle. The oligarchy, which created America, is dead. And with that, America is dead. The labels are still here. The flags are still flying around. There's still a constitution in some vault somewhere. But the founding spirit and the people, the tradition upon which that spirit is based, was completely gone by the 1950s.
I did not know that George Washington swore in on the Masonic Bible.
I'm pretty sure of that. Now,
what exactly is the Masonic Bible? Is it?
It's basically just a reprinting of the Bible with that stupid foreword about the great architect of the universe that you just saw, that you just read to us.
Gotcha. So, sort of like the Jehovah's Witnesses have something called the Watchtower Bible, which is the Old and New Testament with certain theological concepts and words slightly modified, but it does have. It does have the Watchtower stamp on there, so that makes sense. I did not know that, though.
Yeah, I'm actually going to stand behind that statement. Yeah, it was. I just Googled it. We're good.
All right, Google. We're good then.
Wikipedia actually gets the credit for that one, where I get all my academics resource.
It's excellent. So Washington, our first president, he was in the Masonic Lodge. How about current political figures that we know of today, presidents? Legislators, judges.
Well, you've had these secret societies, especially thriving around Ivy League schools and stuff like the Skull and Bone Society and things like that, which are very similar in nature to Freemasonry, with a very similar purpose and outlook and goals. So you've had up through very recently, and probably now. You still have these sorts of secret social networking and esoteric and initiatic guilds of one form or another. But Freemasonry itself, if they are members, the Freemasonry has become so absolutely castrated and irrelevant that it no longer has any impact on American politics.
Okay, that's an important point, and that reminds me, I skipped a question I was wanting to know. What are the other secret societies that are more important today? You mentioned the Skull and Bones. We know George W. Bush was a member of that. What are the secret societies today that are important? Do you know about that?
Well, the revolution in communications has sharply affected the the growth and development of secret societies. And people need to understand how technology and the differing media world we live in and the internet have really changed the political landscape for the people who are hiding as well. Like, if you look at Scientology, when L. Ron Hubbard created Scientology, which has a secretive initiatic core to it, you know, it has this exoteric shell that you see of goofy sci-fi nonsense, and then it gets even goofier and more sci-fi in the middle. But they had this series of secrets, basically like Freemasonry and a lot of secret societies, where you slowly work up the chain and you learn new secrets, and you're so invested, and they do the thing with the confessions where you... you know, you're audited and stuff like that, so they have dirt on you, and those are all unifying elements of secret societies. And what happened with the internet is all that information is just out there. The Mormon Church, you can go on BitTorrent right now and read some of their books, which were too sacred for anybody but the initiated to read. You can go on there and watch reenactments of their secretive ceremonies with their you know, Masonic gowns and stuff like that on. And a lot of secret societies have been, finger quote, exposed, and a lot of them have gone underground or reverted back to sort of an impotent, castrated, irrelevant golf club of sorts.
Interesting.
It's just a casual networking thing because they have trouble keeping secrets anymore. It's harder to keep secrets now than it was before the age of distributed media.
This is true. I wonder also whether it would be, given the technology we have today, whether it would be, in some senses, even more easy to share things in terms of how quick you can do it with the electronics and so forth. But I guess you're arguing that there's someone that owns the data, so it's not really secret, right?
Well, you know,
if I try to send you a text message, I'm sorry.
Are there opportunities for esoteric activity in the information age? I'd say absolutely. But I think that may have been a sufficient challenge to trip up a lot of these older ones. You know, how would Freemasonry adapt to the information age with text message trees? And you're seeing that with you know, a study of the Antifa and how they do their thing. Or, you know,
I was just thinking about that whenever you and Janelle put together the David Irving conference. You explicitly did not give information about that until about a half hour before the presentation, and you sent everyone text messages, and sure enough, the Antifa were there. They had somehow sniffed out the location of where David Irving would be presenting, and they came there, and they got the little hotel to shut it down.
We did end up having that conference, by God.
We did.
in my apartment.
On your couch.
Great
pizza,
you know,
too.
With pizza. It was. I think it was more pleasant than it would have been at the hotel, and a victory. But the real victory came a few months later when the primary Antifa cells here in Indiana got themselves tripped up in that Tinley Park fiasco, and have been struggling ever since.
Good. That's good to know. Let's talk about how the average person can fight back against the political machinations of secret societies and the oligarchs like those in, you know, Freemasonry and those today and other secret societies. What do we do about it? What can we do about it?
You have to network. And I guess my answer would be have our own secret societies. And that's something you have to build relationships. And so much you think, well, I'll just print up some flyers and I'll go around downtown. I'll do this directly. The world, the political world, and this I've published, or not published, but I wrote a review of George Washington Plunkett's famous book, Plunkett of Tammany Hall. And it's just about the nature of the political process, about how you've got to scratch people's backs, you've got to set aside differences, even stark differences, in pursuit of a common goal. You've got to help raise money. These are things that were done in the Masonic Lodge. The things done in there aren't inherently, or those things done weren't inherently bad. They're things we need to be doing too. And their basic networking, being able to keep secrets, that's a huge thing that Freemasonry took very seriously. And to their credit, is, you know, everybody in the white nationalist movement, if they find out some dirt on somebody, what do? They run out and they share it with everybody, even if it's not relevant to movement concerns. Even if it's not they just can't keep their mouths shut, if you will. And that's something that discipline, networking, a lot of the things you learn from secret societies. You don't have to wear the apron or believe in the grand architect of the universe to learn a lot of valuable things about practical politics from studying how these secret societies actually operated.
That's a good point. It's always important to remember that the strategies aren't really what's evil about them. It's the, in many cases, the ends that they use those means. Any last things you want to say about our subject matter, whether it's the Jewish issue or secret societies?
Yeah, there is one last thing, and this kind of walks all the way back to the Merlin Miller concern we, sure, had at the beginning of the show. Is you have to draw these definitive lines, or you'll be subverted. That's what happened with Freemasonry. Jews were allowed to join. Jews were allowed to engage, and they did. And they hijacked that vehicle, and they drove it off a cliff, and it's ruined now. Now, my interests aren't aligned with Freemasonry, but Freemasonry is, ironically, a white Western institution that was hijacked and destroyed by Jews. And you look, you know, that's one thing that concerns me about the A3P. I'm certainly not saying that Merlin Miller's on the side of the Jews. Far from it. He's, you know, a staunch opponent to Zionism, and would, you know. But at the same time, you look at, like, the John Birch Society. It started out as this very robust thing in defense of our interests. And where did it go? It got really big, and it compromised its core principles, and it became an enemy of us. National Review, William F. Buckley was writing in favor of segregation and against affirmative action back in the 60s and early 70s. And then what did he do? Well, he compromised, and that institution, which was a bulwark of traditional America, drifted into where now you go to National Review, and what are they doing? They're attacking us.
Yep.
The Democratic Party. It started out as, you know, being very strongly opposed to integration.
Right.
Where is it now? The Democratic Party.
Yeah.
You know, that's how these things get away from us. And labor unions back in the 20s were, you know, carrying on about the Jewish capitalist global menace. And where did they go? Well, they, you know, socialism used to be our thing. Now it's not. All these things slip away from us, and we've got to stop letting our vehicles get hijacked. And that's why, you know, when somebody says, "Oh, well, this explicitly pro-white, explicitly anti-Zionist vehicle you got there, you mind if I take the keys for a minute and drive it in a non-pro-white direction?" You know, you're probably not going to get your car back. And
great point.
If you do, it's not going to be drivable anymore. You know, it's going to toons as the driving cat right off the cliff. So that's my problem with that. Is there's been so much investment in the A3P, and there's so many good people working with the A3P. It is I don't want to see that vehicle get lost.
Yeah.
And all that time get wasted, because we have to draw the line somewhere. And if the A3P, you know, really insists on going in a civic nationalist direction, I don't know why they would do that tactically, but that's a separate issue. If they think that's a smart way to go, then they go that way. I'm staying here. I'm not getting in a vehicle that's going that direction, because I've seen bottom of the cliff is just littered with vehicles.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Would you mind taking a couple questions from the chat room and then one caller?
Oh, okay, absolutely.
First question is from Mickey. Did Jews in towns without synagogues use Masonic temples as a substitute?
I'm not qualified to answer that.
You've got Google, man. Google it.
I could Google it right now.
Kidding.
I would encourage a reader to I don't know.
There you go, Mickey. Google it.
We'll look that up. Yeah.
Second question.
All the questions.
Okay. Second question for Mickey. Was there a strong presence of law enforcement and judges in Freemasonry?
Oh, yes, very much so. Anybody who was connected was in traditional America in the late 19th, early 20th century was Masonic. I mean, that's a bit of an overstatement, but yeah, that was the basic thing, was the judges, the attorneys, the church leaders. That's where they all came together, and where big decisions were made, where America happened, if you will.
Okay. And before we wrap up, we have a caller, and his name is Tyrone Kente Williams, and Tyrone. You are live on Tribal Theocrat Live. What's your question for Matt Parrott?
Yeah. Mr. Payroll?
Yes, how are you doing?
Is this Mr. Matthew Payroll?
Yes, it is.
I just want to say, if you don't want to get your vehicle hijacked, you don't need to be parking in the ghetto. That's just what I'm saying, though, for real. You know what I mean, for real. You know, if you don't want your vehicle hijacked, you don't need to be parking in the ghetto. That's all I had to say. Thank you, Mr. Matthew Payroll.
Thank you very much, Tyrone. I didn't catch his last name.
His last name here is, I think it's Tyrone Kente.
Well, I'm sure there's actually some very deep, I know Tyrone's an extremely intelligent gentleman of color.
He is.
There's probably some profound allegorical relevance to not parking your vehicle in the ghetto if you don't want to get it hijacked.
Oh, there has to be. One last question. This is from Dave. Can Matt comment on the relationship between communist Jews and Fabian socialist Masons? Tough questions.
I really can't comment on that. I wouldn't be surprised, I guess, is as far as I'm comfortable going with that.
Yeah. And by the way, for the record, that Tyrone's last name was Williams. Tyrone Kente Williams, thanks for calling, brother.
Tyrone Kente Williams.
We are.
That's the thing about black gentlemen is they always have such esteemed old American last names. It's always Williams or Jefferson or Washington.
Yeah, and just so people know, this program right here is very inclusive and diverse. We welcome all callers and guests. Well, callers at least. Okay, a few more questions about you. This is not related to the subject, but. You as an individual, what projects are you working on, Matt? I know you well enough to know that you always have a couple projects going on. What's going on in your life right now?
Well, I did take a few months off for some personal matters. I'm back in the mix. I couldn't get away from white advocacy if I wanted, I'm afraid. Right now, what we're doing is I'm working pretty much exclusively with Countercurrents, the Countercurrents Publishing, www.counter-currents.com. And what we're developing right now is several radio shows, coalescing them into a Countercurrents radio network. We already have signed up and doing shows. We have Paul Fromm, Tom Sunick, Keith Preston, Stan Hess, Robert Stark, Greg Johnson, and Matt Parrott here within the next week, not sure exactly what day, we'll be hosting a radio show on the network.
That sounds great. So when will this show start?
This show, I don't know exactly what day next week, but we're definitely going live with it. And it's going to be an exciting, it's going to be the Matt Parrott Report. And we're going to be interviewing a variety of guests, hitting some hard-hitting issues. We're also going to be covering current events and just getting our message out there and eventually going off in some deeper directions for real-world change.
Outstanding. And at tribaltheocrat.com, we have a post about today's show with Matt Parrott. There is a link there to Matt's writings, and countercurrents.com is linked on that page. So that's how you can get in connection with Matt and his current and future work. Are there any other contacts you want to give people to get in touch with you?
Parrott.matt@gmail.com. They can go to my Swarm Strategies website. They can find me on Facebook. I'm all over the internet. It's hard not to end up contacting me if you're on the internet.
Just Google Matt Parrott and you'll get in touch with him. Well, Matt, I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about this subject, one which I knew nothing about. It's been very educational. The podcast on demand will be available by Monday morning. And thank you again, Matt.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. If you don't mind, stick on the line and I'll wrap up with you off the air. And thank you for joining us at tribaltheocrat.com for the Tribal Theocrat Live Show. We'll see you next time.